Happy Sunday to you out there in the world of podcast land. How about that? My name is Bay Ragney. You're listening to Totally Driven Radio Rocks. And I have, might be my, I really think it is, my favorite interview of 2018 that I've done. I got to sit down and talk to the other day, a legend. Let's just get it out there. This guy is a musical legend, a heavy metal legend, an icon, and he's missed. I think he's missed. I miss him, but, you know, but I'm sure a lot of people will agree with me. But that man is the one and only K.K. Downing, formerly of the band Judas Priest. And he's got a new book out there called Heavy Duty, and his autobiography, and it's really a good read or listen. I do the audiobook thing, so... we talk about that. We talk about the audiobook. We talk about a lot of stuff with Judas Priest, you know, past, present, and possibly future. Just a lot of good stuff. It's 50 minutes long, the interview. And it really was truly an honor. I mean, Judas Priest was my personal very first concert. And I was telling KK as the interview starts about that. And I was 14 years old. I'm here in the Philadelphia area. It was the Philadelphia Spectrum. Great White was opening, a brand new band from LA. And yeah, it was me and my buddies, and we had just graduated eighth grade, and that was our graduation presents from our parents, was to go see Judas Priest. It was tickets to see Judas Priest. And it was Defenders of the Faith Tour, 1984. Great times. Good times, and truly a life-changing moment for me. So all these years later, excuse me, to get to actually sit and talk to KK, and truly a beautiful person, a beautiful human being, very nice conversation. And when I taped this the other day, a few people I've talked to, they were asking me about it and all, and I just kept saying, I can't wait to share this. I can't wait for people to hear this. And the moment's here. So you don't need to hear me keep babbling on about it. He doesn't really need no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway. Here he is. Here is my interview with K.K. Downing.
My very first concert I ever went to was Judas Priest, and it was 1984 here in Philadelphia on the Defenders of the Faith Tour.
Right.
Changed my life.
That's cool. Would that be Defenders of the Faith Tour, maybe?
It was. It really was, yes.
Yeah, that was a great stage set. Yeah, that was a great tour, to be fair.
I was 14 years old at the time, and I got to be honest, like, I was scared. I didn't know what to expect going to see my first concert. And it really was, and I'm sure it happens for most kids at that young age when they go to that concert. It's truly a life-changing moment.
It does happen. I think everybody must go through it, you know. Maybe for some people it might be something else, whatever that might be. You know, but I think for so many people, it's one concert or another that just blows people away. And people think, wow, you know, it stays with them, you know, and it's hard to get to sleep that night, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, especially at that time with MTV and all, I mean, you're seeing it on TV, it's one thing, but to finally get to experience it live, it's just a completely another animal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like I say, it certainly happened to me at the Hendrix concerts. I was kind of transformed. I was kind of trans everything after that, I think, really, you know.
Yeah, I was, as I was going through your book and on and seeing how, I mean, Jimi Hendrix was that huge influence on you that really kind of made you pick up the guitar. And it made me think, like, you know, in all your years of touring, was there any other guitar players that you might have toured with that, like, really left an impression on you that you would actually, like, take time to go and watch?
Yeah, not as much as Hendrix did, because I'll say it was so early on, wasn't it? Around about 67, something like that, you know? I mean, like you say, once you've had that initial experience, it just, like, totally rocks your head off.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to experience it again, you know. It's just something kind of magical that happens.
Sure. And it's rare for a magical person to come onto the scene like Hendrix. So to be able to experience that and try to find somebody else to live up to that, it's kind of hard.
Yeah. Because I do tell the story. I think I was lucky to see him a few times, you know, earlier on. When I say early, Hendrix, unfortunately, we had a very short window with him. You know, just a few years, really. But the first couple of years when I was seeing him, he was kind of, I think, unaffected by the business and anything else that might have been going on in his life, you know. I think, you know, towards the end, and I think it's fairly well documented that he did have some problems with management and felt kind of threatened and, you know, and did various things. So, and it does, obviously, you know, but when I saw him, he was obviously there. He was out to kill, out to impress, and he was, and everyone in England went to see him. I mean, Clapton went to see him, Pete Townsend went to see him, I do think that he was kind of unaffected and total free spirit and certainly at his best.
Yeah, absolutely. And didn't you get a chance to meet him? Am I...
Well, I wouldn't call it meeting, but actually, I did a couple of times. Yeah. One was at the Royal Albert Hall, where he played two shows there. So I was outside the back door, and there was only a couple of people there, really. And I got to say, "Hi, Jimmy, can I get your autograph? I had this nice poster for him to sign and that, you know." And I didn't have the balls to say too much more, really. And the other time was at the Isle of Wight. I managed to find out his dressing room, which was like an English-style caravan. And I was able to lift up the windows, and all of the band and a couple of girls were sitting around the table just before he went on. And I managed to get a Coca-Cola bottle off Jimmy that he'd just finished drinking, and a drumstick from Mitch.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I was kind of, I couldn't really speak. I'd got my head stuck through this little window that lifted up, you know, kind of vertically. But at some point I must have overstayed my welcome and the window had to come down, but those guys had to go on stage.
You know, it's funny, like you tell that story and then, I've been listening to the audiobook of your book. And, I was just up to the point, earlier where, you guys were doing I think it was a record store signing, and a woman wanted you guys to sign her newborn twins.
Yes, it's true. She turned around and picked these babies up. They were absolutely tiny. She turned around and put them straight smack in front of us. And she wanted us to sign them, you know, on their skin. And I'm saying, no, we can't do that. You know, we could sign the clothes. Sign the baby's clothes. But, yeah, I've signed a lot of things in my life, but that was pretty... unique, really.
Do you think that was definitely the weirdest thing that somebody asked you to sign?
It was, really. I mean, they must have been like a week old or something, you know. It was like, wow. It was pretty scary, you know.
I can only imagine the things that you guys witnessed on the road over the years.
Yeah, it takes a fair bit to make us go, you know, me, Glenn, and Rob, it would take a fair few things, you know. We've signed an awful lot of things in our life, you know, but that was pretty different.
Now, speaking of the audiobook, I was actually kind of surprised you had Maxwell Caulfield did the actual reading of the book. Now, did you pick him, or did you have any say in that, or?
I did. Now, the thing is, they sent me over five guys, I think, and they sent me five guys, and the guy I chose was the best out of the guys. That's all I can say. And this, you know, what he was reading, you know, which wasn't very long, you know, was all I had to go on.
Sure.
But you know, does he do a good job in there, Dave? Is he good or not?
Absolutely. I was just taken back initially. Like, I was like, wow, that Maxwell Caulfield. And I mean, originally I think of Grease 2 with him, but the big one I think of is, you know, the whole Rex Manning from Empire Records, which is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I don't know him. I had no idea who he was. They gave me the name. But I was all, you know, I mean, I didn't know. I just thought they were people that did this sort of thing.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Because when I started listening to it the other day, I actually like stopped and I looked at my wife and I'm like, guess who's doing the reading of this? And she just looked at me and said, Maxwell Caulfield. And her face is kind of like scrunched up. Like, really? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason I chose him because, it was, out of all the guys, he was, from what I heard anyway, I think he had the most talent for it. Out of the five guys, I think he was the most talented reader. That's what I think. And he didn't have any particular twang to his accent, where a couple of the other guys, I could hear a little bit of Aussie Australian in them, and another guy I could hear a little bit of Merseyside, Liverpool, you know. And I hope I made the right choice.
I
hope I did.
I definitely think you did.
I was quite impressed because he had the best ability, and it showed even in the snippet that I had. You know, so I know I picked the best out of the five snippets. You know, what I got to listen to. I know that for a fact. You know. The only thing is my voice is different to his voice, but everybody's is, you know. I thought we could be looking forever and a day, but he's certainly a talented reader is what I thought. And I will have to get a copy of the audio just to see, and I hope I'm pleased with what I hear.
Did you think about doing it at all yourself?
Yeah, I did. But it would have took me forever, really, you know. I mean, it's not the easiest thing to do, is it, really, you know. I mean, the one thing Max did, because they only got one stab at reading and recording that, you know. They went in the studio and they had to do it on the fly.
Right.
And so Max was able to, at one point, he was reading and he laughed a little bit, you know. A little bit of laughter, you know. So to preempt that, it's kind of difficult, you know.
Sure.
And it was good. It was good. I hope it's good. You enjoying it?
I am.
It's okay. Good. 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 Good.
Absolutely. Does it shock you at all the reaction it's been getting? I mean, like you're the headline every day. There's a new headline of you on a like Blabbermouth.
It's getting. I'm immensely busy. I've been going today from 2 p.m. and I finish. My last call is at 8 o'clock when I finish speaking to you, you know. So I'll probably have my slippers and pipe and dressing gown on by then.
Now, are you still, like, you still pick up the guitar a lot? Are you still playing? Do you still write music at all? Or?
Yeah, I've got a little Marshall amp at a Flying V in my office. I'm looking at it now. I'll pick it up now and again. But I do some stuff, you know. I play some solos and stuff. But I don't. It's difficult for me to have time because I'm always doing things. And now this book's happening, you know, because on a global scale, I'll speak to people from New Zealand, Bogota. I spoke to people in Colombia, radio station, a couple of days ago. I speak to, obviously, Spain, Czech Republic, did yesterday. I did a book signing in Nottingham yesterday. I did an interview with the Czech Republic in the car at the train station before I got on the train yesterday. you know, so I'm speaking to Norway, obviously Finland. So at the moment, apart from the US, Canada, and those territories, South America, we've got the UK, Finland, Bulgaria, Germany. I'm trying to think where else now is actually releasing the book, but I think a lot more people will come on board, you know, with the success that it's been, sure. You know, which is good.
Has it really kind of opened your eyes to, like, the, you know, the what you've left over the years with all these people around the world? Is it kind of like, wow, like, okay, I really left an impression with everybody?
Yeah, I think it's good, and I think what's happening as well, Bae, is the fact that I speak to a lot of people, and time's moving on. We're all getting older, and lots of people have an appreciation for, you know, obviously the concerts they've seen and the albums that they've bought, and that association, really, you know, that we have as having been on a journey together, really. And I think there is an awareness that time's moving on. It's not particularly on anybody's side. I'm going to be 67 in a month's time, you know, so getting up there. Glenn's going to be 71 this month. We're just a couple of days away. Our birthday is apart. And Rob's also 67, just gone. Ian's going to be 67 in January. So obviously we're losing quite a few people along the way, which is unfortunate. It's a shame, but you know, at some point, you know, the experience that we all had, you know, from the late 60s onwards, the 70s, the 80s, you know, the 90s up until now, I think. That is it fair to say that in the last decade or so, or maybe a bit more, really, things have changed, you know. I mean, metal started to change, didn't it, really, from what we know as classic metal, started to change sometime in the 90s, really, where it got a bit more heavier and a bit more diverse with all the genres of metal, black metal, death metal, whatever metal, right. You know. And since then, it's become... It's not become everybody's cup of tea, really, and I suppose I have to admit myself, you know, I'm just enjoying listening to Dokken again. They've just got back together after 20 years, and I'm enjoying their shows on YouTube. Really good. So, you know, I tend to, you know, listen to a lot of... And I put time, you know, I mean, Doro's just released a new album, Saxon, Udo... Accept bands like that still keep flying the flag for what we know as classic metal. So, you know, I try to listen to that. But is it, it's hard to keep reinventing the wheel, I guess, isn't it, really? So, don't know exactly, you know, as opposed to, let's say, the 80s, where every week a new superstar band would be born, wouldn't it? Whether it was Great White or whether it was Guns N' Roses or whether it was... You know, Metallica, or I mean, whoever it was, you know, it was somebody every week. Somebody seemed to be coming to the forefront, and it was great times, you know. And there was a feel good factor in the music industry with everything that was thriving. Obviously, MTV was about, you know, it was good, loads of fun.
Absolutely.
And loads of bands could make loads of funny and sexy girl videos, you know, with great songs, whoever it was.
Do you think like the music business side of it has also, like, I know there was, you know, you just weren't happy overall when you decided to leave Judas Priest, but do you think the music business side of it too as well was part of it as well, or was it just more with the situation within the band?
I think the thing is, we as Judas Priest, unlike a lot of less fortunate bands, we kind of were on terra firma, really, because we had done what we'd done, and we were kind of, you know, reached a certain level and standard, you know, that I think that there would always be an audience and a marketplace for Judas Priest, so that was okay. that was okay. It was just the shine had gone somewhat. You know, it became more of a chore to be out on the roads. You know, it wasn't, you know, there wasn't 100 girls lined up outside backstage waiting for the band bus to arrive, you know, which had, you know, it was, it had all kind of changed a little bit, you know, but nothing really mattered as long as we really enjoyed playing and performing, and that wasn't really happening for me also. But, you know, I was doing my best and playing my part, you know, but, you know, I looked around and it just seemed like the shine had come off, you know, the band's performance, you know, going through the motions a bit, really. Right. You know, and I kind of missed Priest being the forceful energy that it always had been, you know. I mean, my saying was, you know, guys, the older we get, the younger we've got to play.
Right.
And I don't think we're always, like, teamed up with the right packaging, support bands and stuff all the time. And I think generally mistakes were being made, and I don't think it was being looked after properly, really.
Did you do, like, listen to the new album that they put out earlier this year, Firepower? Have you listened to any of the music that was made after you left, or?
Yeah, I've listened to some of it, you know. I think the thing is, as I said before, you know, keeping up the standard and everything, even with the big guns helping in the studio, you know, with not one producer but two, you know, excellent guys, you know. It's still hard to come up with songs that you could say would be, you know, you can listen to an album in its entirety, but I always think, I'm always listening, which song is the one song that is going to be that classic Judas Priest song,
right?
You know, off this album. Isolate that one song out, give it to me, you know, and what's the song about? What's the message to me? You know, is it Victim of Change? Is it Breaking the Law? Is it Blood Red Skies? Is it Beyond the Realms of Death? You know, it's which is the song that's going to stay there forever?
Right.
And it's hard because I know when the guys came out with the album before, Redeemer of Souls, you know, it was this and it was that and it's this and it's great and the fans loved it. But I stand corrected, bro. I don't think the band's playing any songs at all from that album on tour.
I'm not sure on that.
I don't think that they are, but, you know, but I think the main thing is they don't completely sound like a Judas Priest album. Can I say that? Can I say that?
Sure.
Well, I just did, because some kind of, you know, lots of kind of, I could be completely wrong, but maybe it's just me. You know, but then again, if you pull in different writers, you know, etc., then for the album, then it's going to sound different if you change the writing team, surely.
Right.
We've all been to that restaurant and the head chef's on his night off.
Right.
It's not the same, is it?
That's true.
Can it be the same?
No, not at all. It's completely different.
Everybody, we do it differently, but, you know, I think the guys did well to do what they did, you know, to come up with an album. It's tough to keep coming up with the goods, I guess, sure, after all of this time.
Sure. Now, going back to the book, some of the things that really stood out to me, one of the things was that when you were talking about when Rob came on board and you kind of compared it to you really needed to step things up and really, it was more of like a motivational factor for you, it sounded like, where you wanted to make sure you kept Rob with the band and you didn't want to lose him, kind of like Trapeze did with
Glenn Hughes, yeah.
Yeah, to Deep Purple. And I don't think I ever heard anybody say that in an interview before, and it kind of like, I was like, wow, like that was just really eye-opening.
Yeah, because Rob Halford, you know, there's not many people on the planet that can do what he does, you know, singers. I mean, Ralph Schapers, obviously the German guy from Gamma Ray, he's got a hell of a vocal range and delivery. Ripper Owens, the same sort of thing. You know, there's some other singers out there, but they don't have the texture and the strength and the delivery. They might have the range, but the some of the guys, the size of the vocals seems to shrink down a little bit, but I've probably missed some good guys out. But, you know, there's not many people that can step in. We found that out when we were looking for another singer to replace Rob.
Sure.
I mean, it took us a long time to find the right, to find somebody that could get close, really, you know. So it was pretty tough to do. So he's pretty unique. So way, all those years way back then, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, we were, the same thing could have happened to us, you know. You know, Deep Purple could have, if it had been a bit, you know, if the timing would have been a bit different, you know, they could have come to Rob, you know. Anything could have happened, really.
Sure.
So I knew that we had to, I had to create a good strength of support behind, you know, to back, you know, with Rob, really, as a front man and singer. And that's why I thought having two lead guitar players in a band, one, it's different. Two, I can deliver up what I want to deliver up, which is, you know, two, you know, not, most bands had a rhythm player and a lead player, you know, but I'm thinking lead players, they can play lead, they can certainly play rhythm, and usually they can write some songs as well. So that was fortifying the band, you know, and it was, and it did. So that was a good move. And I was pretty excited by it to see what we could actually do with the, you know, twin guitar attack. And that's what it became known as, really.
Sure.
You know. And then it became the mainstay eventually of rock and metal, you know, as we know today.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you had mentioned about when, you know, on the search to replace Rob when Rob left, and then you guys finally found Tim. Did you guys think at any point during those, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, it didn't take a few years for you guys to find Tim. Did you guys think at any moment or any time, maybe we should just, you know, pack it in?
I think the story goes, because I tell in the book that I actually wrote a leaving letter at the same time as Rob left. You know, but I didn't deliver it up. I sat on it for a while.
Okay.
And then, you know, I didn't, before I had a chance to deliver it, if I was going to, Rob announced that he was leaving. So I just let everything just lay there, you know.
Sure.
And then Glenn suddenly, a bit of one-upmanship, whatever it was, oh, yeah, I'm going to do a solo album as well. I'm thinking, okay, I'll let all this settle down, see if Rob comes back, let Glenn do his solo thing, if that's what he's going to do, you know, I'll kind of have sit back and take stock and see what happens next. And then some years went by, waiting for, Rob didn't come back. Glenn went on forever doing his records with other artists, you know.
Right.
And then when Glenn had finished that, we kind of, the serious look for a new singer was put into effect, and by that time I'm thinking, well, you know what, I've sat on a byline for quite a while, you know, I've got some energy, heard Ripper, heard his vocals, thinking, God, that guy's very, very good, you know, seriously good. And decided to give it a go, really. And a lot of it was really, because Rob had said a lot of things, you know, that were unfair, really, like things like priests weren't heavy enough for him and all of that. Right. So I'm thinking a lot of it was right, well, okay, we'll show Rob what it's all about. And I think we did that in Fine Star, to be fair, compared to what he was putting out.
Yeah, it was, it kind of sounds like it was almost kind of, not a war, but I guess kind of a war of music versus music in your eyes.
Yeah, it was really. Rob even called his album War of Words, and there was a war of words, you know, a lot of war of words. A lot of it was a good read. Some of it was pretty funny, I've got to say. You know, some of it was funny. we had to laugh, some of the name calling, because, you know, the gloves were off, if you know what I mean.
Sure, sure.
All the gloves were on, whichever way around it is. So it was fun. So it was kind of okay. Rob will be seriously jealous when he sees Rip, because one, he'll probably two. Did I say that? he's going to think, fuck, that guy can really sing as good as I can, you know. So it was fun. There were some fun times to be had.
Oh, that's
fun. You know, making the best of it, so to speak. You know, I can laugh. It was serious, really, because, you know, we had a fan base out there, and we had to, you know, do what we thought was, acceptable.
Sure. Now, how about like when the Screaming for Vengeance album like really started to break? How quick did things change? And did you think like, oh, here comes the ride? It's really going to get wild now.
When Screaming for Vengeance broke, yeah. Sorry, babe. Then you said it. Sorry, babe. Going back to Screaming for Vengeance, yeah. We made the record. It was full pelt. It was our most successful record ever. The timing was just right. And what else did you say?
When it broke, did you think to yourself like, oh, this is going to get like a wild ride right now?
Yeah, it was. It was great, because, you know, I think that as much as we had done to try to get our beloved music accepted by the masses, you know, it wasn't really until Screaming for Vengeance came along and we thought, well, you know what, this is pretty much done it. This has pretty much achieved what we wanted to do to get, you know, fully fledged metal band on the radio in this kind of to this extent is pretty successful, really, to be fair.
Right. Now, how about I don't think you actually really covered it too much in the book from what I've heard so far, but Live Aid, when you guys were asked to play Live Aid, were you guys kind of shocked at that, or?
No, somebody said, like, you know, with this big, potentially a big charity thing, it's called Live Aid, it's in a good cause. We were told we were the fifth band to accept that. That's what they told me.
Oh, wow.
And then what was really cool was to see that, you know, because it just kind of snowballed and snowballed and snowballed. And it was great. You know, I feel proper good about accepting it very, very early on to do it, you know.
Sure.
Because obviously once, I don't think the names were particularly big or suited to the rock and metal genre, really.
Right.
The names of the guys that had already accepted. So when Priest did, obviously, that helped a lot. And then when other bands accepted it, you know, just something like that, you know, can happen. It was quite magical. Everybody gave their time up, you know, and whatever the cost was, we flew in from. We were only in the Bahamas, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a big journey for us. But everything was at our expense, and we were happy to do it, delighted to do it, and delighted to be a part of it.
Yeah, that was one of the magical moments again.
It really was, you know. It was probably something we'll never see again, you know. But and the bands, I mean, it was just amazing. I woke up in the hotel, obviously in Philly in the morning, put the television on, and I'm thinking, fuck. I think, who was on? Was it Status Quo, maybe, in the UK, you know? So I'm thinking, Jesus, I'm playing this show today, you know? Because it was on both sides of the Atlantic, you know? So it was all a vibe. The whole thing was a vibe. And guys flying in after they'd done that show, you know? We were all in the hotel. It was mad, you know? We were all arriving en masse, and nobody got past the reception area, you know, because we'd be there checking in, then Sabbath would come in, and we start talking, and then somebody else comes in, and then, oh, you know, nobody got to the rooms, really. It just started to fill up. It was good fun.
Now, one thing you really did touch on in the book, and I remember thinking this myself, was the whole era when you guys did the Turbo album and kind of changed the musical direction with the guitar synths and stuff like that. Were you scared that you would end up pissing off a lot of the longtime Judas Priest fans?
No, I didn't really think about it. We were just, I mean, right about that time, everything was at a peak, I think, really, you know, in rock and metal and what everywhere. All of the bands, so many bands were successful right there and then. You know, so many of them. It was a great time, such a good feel factor. MTV was in full flight, playing everybody, really. It was good. And we thought that, you know, there and then in America, there would be an acceptability, you know, again, for us to push whatever boundaries we felt like pushing. And we did the tour. We did the album. And it was really quite successful, you know.
Right.
It's true there was a lot more girls, you know, but I think that was kind of the sign of the times. I mean, like, girls felt a lot safer and a lot more, you know, going to concerts and stuff. And it was good, you know. It was, you know, we were just out there to do as good as we could possibly do at the time, really. Bearing in mind that we'd actually written for a double album, but we kind of thinned the songs out to really produce an album that had a good flow and continuity,
right.
You know, as opposed to being an eclectic mix, and like quite a few of our records had that.
Well, that makes me kind of think, too, of the whole, you know, because it was just, was it this year, I think, the 30th anniversary of the Turbo came out?
Think so, yeah.
Do they consult you on any of that stuff, like packaging?
No.
Wow.
No, which is kind of a bit of a bone of contention. Okay, I might have walked, but I'm still an integral part of the organization. I'm still a director of, Judas Priest Music Limited.
Right.
You know, so I'm still, you know, but they're trying to kind of obviously alienate me in every way that they possibly can. It's one of those things, I guess. I'm the black sheep now. But really, from a business standpoint, I have a right, and I think all bands do that make it so far, to protect and oversee, because, you know, it's not going to be all that long before none of us are up there.
Sure.
You know, so we need to decide what is going to happen. You know, we can't just hand over. I mean, it's like anything else. If you built up Wrigley's or Hershey's, or, you know, I'm just thinking of people, or a business,
yeah.
You know, all your life, you know, you've got investment in that brand.
Right.
You've got a vested interest in that brand because you built it and you own it. You know, the brand name. And there's a great value there, isn't there?
Absolutely. You know?
So that's the bone of contention that's going on really at the moment, is the fact that, okay, if you're not going to take the opportunity to research, if I'm able to and willing to step back in, then you need to do the whatever needs to be done, you know, out of courtesy and respect to the business. Well, so, but anyway, that's all for lawyers and accountants to sort out, I guess.
But on a personal level, I mean, with that situation where you weren't asked to come back in, or, you know, where they don't consult you on these 30th anniversaries of these albums and the repackaging and stuff, like, is it, I mean, there's got to be a lot of hurt there personally. I mean, you guys went through so much.
Yeah, because it is what it is, you know. I tried to speak to the band's accountant saying, look, this makes sense to do this, even though I'm not in the band. Anything could happen at any time. Other people could find themselves in the same situation. We need to protect, you know, a la probably something like Kiss would do to protect the business and to make sure that the standards of production that with the Judas Priest brand on is kept to where it should be.
Right.
And not let it fall away or, you know, fall into hands of that might create some kind of ill repute or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's been quite a few years then since you've talked to any of the guys then.
Yeah, it's been a bit. Actually, I was at Rob's mom's funeral last year.
Okay.
I think it was, you know, not too long, over a year ago. And his dad's funeral before that. You know, it's just all got a bit funky, really. You know, I made a press release from the heart, and I thought I was doing everybody a favor by saying, you know, what credentials Andy Sneap had, all-round credentials, great credentials, you know. I thought that would be a benefit, really, for the fans to know that I would, you know, obviously at least condone his abilities, you know, to be able to go out there. But they maintain I was insinuating that Glenn didn't play on the record, and that was not what I said, or, you know, or what I meant. So I think that they, if they hadn't have said anything, nothing would have happened. You know, that's what I think. Don't think anybody else would have, you know, come up with it. But they made a big hoo-ha out of it, so then it all got a bit ugly, as things do.
Right. Now, do you think, I mean, say if they did turn around and before they talked to Andy or, you know, went through probably like an audition process, if they came to you and you agreed, do you think, I mean, because it sounded like you really weren't happy with, like you said earlier on, you weren't happy with the touring and the way things were being run and just the overall situation. Do you think you would end up being happy back in there?
I think that this is it. You know, I go back in and I'm saying, okay, guys, let's turn the clock back a couple of decades. You know, let's go back to where we were. You know, let's have the equality, the level playing field, the democracy and everything.
Right.
You know, that needs to be in situ because that being in a band, that's it. You're a team player, end of story, you know. Ego's out the window, you know, the pecking order has to go, you know, and obviously, you know, if Glenn's not playing, that alleviates the fact that my nervousness on stage, because Glenn liked a few beers, you know, and he had a right to do it his way, you know, I had a right to do it my way, something I had to give. But obviously, if the guys would have said, look, KK, you know, Glenn's not there now, you're not there, you know, we've got to take the best Priest out that we possibly can for the fans, you know, we want you back in, mate, you know, come and get it sorted, then, you know, under those terms, it would have all made a lot of sense.
Right.
You know, so Richie steps over to where Glenn was, and I resume my normal, you know, and it would have been an acceptable, understandable, given Glenn's unfortunate, you know, condition.
Right.
It would have been as good as we can do. And to be honest, I think me and Richie would have made a pretty dynamic, you know, because I would have made sure that the firepower wasn't just on a damn record. It would have been on the stage as well, you know.
Right.
That's what needed to happen. you know, because people expected that energy from Priest. They would expect it, you know, as opposed to it just being, I don't know, doesn't look right or feel right as it is at the moment. But obviously the guys are still going to put on a great show, great songs. But if they like it the way that it is, what can I say? You know, I got fed up of mistakes being made, really, along the way. And that's why...
What if they came, like, with right now, with Kiss, like, Kiss just announced the end of the road tour. They're going to go on this big farewell 3-year-long world tour. What if, you know, next year... After they, I don't know if they are planning the tour already for next year or not, but what if they turn around and say, hey, Ken, look, we're thinking about doing a farewell tour. Would you come back on board, be part of the farewell tour, but they want to keep, you know, Richie and Andy in place and have 3 guitars. Would you be interested in something like that?
No.
No?
No. I don't think it's synonymous with what Priest do. It's a twin guitar affair, and that's all that's needed and required. You know, there would be some redundancy, I think, really, for a third player.
Right.
I mean, I'm a lead player. Richie's a lead player. Glenn's a lead player. Andy, as good as he is, I think Kevin used to play most of the stuff in his band Hell, but, you know... So you see, I like Andy, and I consider him a friend, and I've been up to his studio, and I've worked with him with younger bands up there, you know, and I know how good he is. You know, he's a great all-round guy, but his love and passion really is, by and large, in the production area, you know. And,
right.
But obviously, he's a massive fan of Priest, you know, and I wish him well, and I wish them all well, you know. I mean... something could happen to me where I'm not able to do it anymore, then it isn't an option, is it, you know?
Right.
I mean, they're talking about a 50th anniversary, but I was in the band in 1969. Rob wasn't, you know, or Glenn. And they weren't there in 1970 or 71 either. Or 72, for that matter. I'm trying to think if I got my dates right. Ian was there, bless him. Ian was there, so we'll have to see.
Absolutely,
you know, it could be. I don't know. A good 50th anniversary would be Rob, me, Ripper, Ian, Scott, Les Bings, Glenn, and everybody that did actually play. Now, that would be some kind of tour to go and see, maybe.
Sure, absolutely. So how about even that? Like, so you would want Ripper to be part of this too, if there was a farewell tour?
Well, yeah, because the thing is, it would be a 50th anniversary, and probably how much longer is this going to go on? But it's the last opportunity for fans to see not what they're getting now, but to see everybody,
right?
You know, unfortunately, we can't have Dave Holland. What, you know, but everybody else that played in Judas Priest to have an opportunity to. I'm not saying everybody's on stage at the same time.
Yeah.
But you have people come on, play various songs for various people.
Sure.
You know, it's just something that people like me. Think of really. That's not me being to all the spoils, but it's just
to celebrate
just an idea.
Yeah,
just an idea that I had
to celebrate all the, you know, the years and the music and the lineups.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Take people on a journey, on a Judas Priest journey.
Yeah. Now, how about Dave Holland? Did you remain in contact with Dave over the years, or?
I didn't know, because we were busy doing our thing, you know, and I don't know what Dave, you know, we were just busy continuing making records and making music as best we could, you know. Gotcha. So we kind of drifted apart, you know.
Gotcha. Now, how about looking back? Is there like one song you can say you're most proud of, or one album that you can say is definitely like the defining moment for you?
Not really. It's hard to pin it down to one song, you know. But if I had to sum it all up, the whole thing, the whole journey, probably Victim of Changes would probably jump out, because it was there at the very beginning when I was probably, when did I start working on that? I was probably 18, 19
wow.
years old. So, yeah, just quickly touching on Dave before this next call comes in. Yeah, just quickly on Dave Holland, I do regret, actually, that we didn't get together and have a beer, you know, because you always think things and people are going to go on forever, don't you, you know?
Sure.
You know, it isn't one great regret, really, but you always think it's going to happen, you're going to run into people, things are going to happen, you know, so, but unfortunately not to be, sadly.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. But,
yeah.
But,
well, I want to thank you for doing this, and congratulations on the success of the book. It's amazing. It really is. I'm glad I got the opportunity to talk to you.
Well, yeah, thank you. It's always great to obviously have the opportunity to speak to people in cities, you know, obviously like Philly, it's, you know, in a great city, great rock city, a lot of cherished memories. So please give my love to all of the fans and tell them, you know, I hope to see him again one day.
Absolutely. And you know what? I'll take Dave Holland's beer if you come back to Philly. I'll drink that beer with you.
It's a done deal, buddy. Yeah, for sure.
Can I get you to cut a quick yeah. ID for me before you go?
Yeah, go for it.
This is KK Downing, and you're listening to yep. Totally Driven Radio.
Totally Driven Radio. Hi, everyone. This is KK Downing, formerly of Judas Priest, and you're listening to Totally Driven Radio. So crank it up. Don't be shy.
Awesome. Thanks so much, KK. Take care.
Hey, thanks, bae. Cheers, mate. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Dirty Rocks. Bay Ragney here. And there he is, there he goes, and there he was. The one and only KK Downing. It was such a fun interview. It really was. And the one funny part is there was a part I had to edit out. He asked me to edit it out because he didn't want me to air an initial answer to something. And it killed me because once he said it, I was like, oh my God, that is the blabbermouth headline. And then he started laughing about it, and then he was like, you know what, can we keep that off the record? And I said, even said to him, I'm like, you realize you just made the blabbermouth headline? And he was like, I know, please, can we keep that one off the record, because I'm already in enough trouble. So there you go. I out of respect for KK, I did as he pleased, and I kept it off the record. But I hope you did enjoy the interview. It was the interview in full, except for that one little snippet. So I hope you did enjoy it. I totally enjoyed it. I was very honored to be able to do it. Like I said, he's somebody who left a mark on my life and was truly in a life-changing moment of my life when I got to see Judas Priest for that first time. And my first concert, I should say. So there you go. So check it out. Get his book. It's called Heavy Duty. You can get the actual physical copy. It's available at all bookstores, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc., etc. Or you can do the audio version, which is available on Audible, which is what I use. And there's some other outlets as well, I'm sure that it's on. So check it out. There you go. And make sure you check myself out, Bay Ragney. You can like me, love me, follow me, as well as Totally Driven Radio and Totally Driven Entertainment. Like us, love us, follow us, subscribe to us. We are all over social media and many of the podcast outlets, including Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, Stitcher, etc., etc., etc. So do it. Like us, love us, follow us, because we'll do the same thing back to you. So there you go. And tune in this Thursday. We'll be back live. Myself, Nick Wilkinson, and our guests are going to be from Trickster, the drummer Mark Guscott, big, very close friend of the show. He's calling in. He's got some things he's going to be talking about, including he's hosting the Rock and Skull Festival in the month. And he's doing a Guinness Book of World Records largest band situation out in Arizona in a couple weeks. And we're going to talk about that. He's getting ready to break a record. So there you go. As well as we're going to have Stuntman Daredevil Eddie Braun, who did the Snake River Canyon jump that Evel Knievel could not do. He did it last year. And we're going to talk to him. There's a documentary all about it, and it's called Stuntman. And it was just named this past week. Executive producer of this project and documentary is the one and only Dwayne The Rock Johnson. So we're going to find out all the dirt, the details, and much, much more. So tune in Thursday night, Total Gym Radio. Until then, again, Bay Ragney here. Make sure you stay driven. See you, everybody.